Hello, everyone, and welcome again to the Associate Affiliate Cricket Podcast. We've got a big review of World Cricket League Division 3 today, as well as the Papua New Guinea and Hong Kong matches that have been ongoing. Lots of news as well, and to join me for that is my regular co-host, Andrew Nixon. Hi, Andrew.
Hi, Russ. Hi, everybody.
Andrew, we'll start with the WCL 3 that was played in Malaysia. It's obviously a pretty important tournament. It's the last chance for those teams to move into WCL 2 and then potentially the Intercontinental Cup and the World Cup qualifying. Start on day one, because it was a little bit deceptive, I think, the first day of the tournament. Paul played Uganda and somewhat surprisingly perhaps lost by 20 runs. We saw it been bowled out for 193, trying to chase 203 from Uganda, so it was a huge score.
Yeah, and Nepal at one point were sort of well on top of the game. They had Uganda 4 wickets down for just 22 runs, and actually 5 wickets down for 23. Then Salowa and Masaba put on a sort of big partnership for the 6th wicket, which sort of got Uganda back into the game. And yeah, Nepal, their often brittle batting lineup let them down again, unfortunately.
The other thing that was slightly disappointing was the United States looked like they were going to really smashed their way through the tournament by beating Bermuda by 6 wickets, but with 169 balls remaining in that match, they bowled them out for 106 and chased it down very quickly, which had the implication that their net run rate was started strong and stayed strong.
Yeah, I think Bermuda perhaps struggled against the pace of Jermaine Lawson. He took 3 wickets in the game over Usman Shuja, bowled even better, taking 3 for 12. And then USA scored the runs quickly. They lost a few wickets in the process, but it was a pretty comprehensive win. It was looking like maybe the USA had turned a corner, but as we saw later on, that wasn't the case, and they didn't really perform much like that again in the rest of the tournament.
And a very tight match between Malaysia and Singapore. They're often very tight matches. This time Singapore came out on top by 2 wickets, chasing down 198.
Yeah, these two teams know each other well. I think this is the 10th game they've played against each other this year, I think I read somewhere. So when you've got two teams who play against each other that frequently at this level, the games tend to be quite close. And yeah, Singapore just edged out Malaysia, won with 7 balls to spare, and it was a good start for the Singapore team, and not too good a start for the hosts.
Moving to day two, our predictions of Bermuda would struggle seemed to be right on the mark, because again they were bowled out very cheaply for 100 and Paul chased it down in only 11.1 overs. It was an absolute thrashing.
Yeah, very comprehensive win for Nepal there, and showed that how we shouldn't have been too impressed by the USA winning the opening day. Very clinical from Nepal, really. Any time you can bowl a team out for 100 and then chase it in that quickly, the whole game was over in about 3.5 hours. Yeah, so it's a pretty comprehensive win for Nepal, and a good recovery after that disappointing opening day performance.
Yeah, it's not unusual for Nepal to start slowly either, so I suppose we probably shouldn't have been too surprised by that first day loss, although it's something they really need to fix. It's something they probably can't afford to do in WCL2.
No, certainly not. WCL 2 is going to be a lot more cutthroat even than WCL 3, and yeah, they need to sort of get their act together in the opening day and stop being such slow starters. We saw it in the last WCL 3 tournament in Bermuda, of course, when I think they lost their first 2 games for coming back and managing to secure promotion there. And you know, they need to avoid these things in the future.
In the other two games, we saw a bit of a thriller. Uganda won by a single run. They were bowled out for 196. Their batting, as expected, was struggling a little bit. But they managed to keep Singapore down to 195 for 8 off their 50 overs. Very unusual to not quite make the runs when you bat out the overs.
Yeah, very unusual for Singapore. They had a run out towards the last wicket. In fact, on the last ball was a run out, obviously going for the winning runs, and panicking a bit with on the last ball. They needed 2 runs to win and then run out, so they didn't even get get a tie. Yeah, but, you know, another close game for Singapore and another win for Uganda continued a good start to the tournament for them.
And in the other game, the United States were turned over by Malaysia, the home side, which is a fairly important win for Malaysia because if they'd lost that, they would have been 2-0-2. And again, as we just indicated, that USA's first opening day win probably wasn't that impressive because they really kind of struggled a bit in this game, being bowled out for only making 186 off their 50 overs and having that chase down relatively comfortably.
Yeah, we saw Jermaine Lawson, who did so well against Bermuda to take three wickets, bowled eight overs here, went for 44 runs and didn't take a wicket. And very poor performance from him. And I think it's turned out later that he came into the tournament with a bit of an injury. He didn't actually play every game. And I think nearly half the US team was perhaps carrying some sort of injury. We'll talk about the USA's preparation later. But yeah, pretty poor performance from the USA again. And Malaysia sort of bounced back after their opening day defeat.
Yeah, it was also good for Malaysia because they, on the opening day, they lost their fast bowler who'd been very useful for them in the previous tournaments and to injury. So to lose Hassan and then to be able to kind of pull that back in was good for them that they didn't rely on him.
Yeah, teams at this level sometimes tend to rely on one or two players, and it was good to see that Malaysia, after losing probably their best bowler, were still able to restrict the USA to under 200 and then go on to win the game.
Following the rest day, Malaysia, though, they had a bit of a bad day, and we saw Bermuda come up with some runs. They scored 257 for 8 against Malaysia, and it was never really a contest. Malaysia was only made 179 for 7. It was a Duckworth-Lewis reduced target, but they were still 37 runs short, which is threw a few calculations out.
Yeah, very surprising performance from Bermuda in many ways. You saw Burgess scoring 82, Lionel Khan scoring 51, and you have to wonder why couldn't Bermuda have played like that throughout the tournament. They did very well to score 257 for 8, and then Malaysia sort of just fell apart. They had a good start, and with Anwar Aruddin scoring 45, Ahmed Fayez scoring 87, but the rest of the batting order just really didn't contribute.
Yeah, I think judging by some of the fallout, we'll get to why Bermuda struggled in the opening two games, because it seemed to be a preparation thing. The other two games, we saw Nepal and Uganda really start to assert themselves as the class teams of this tournament. Nepal absolutely annihilated Singapore by 190 runs, making 263 and then bowling out for 73.
Nepal could have made even more had someone actually managed to stay in with Gyanendra Mela for a long time. He scored 114, but the next highest score was 29. And so, it could have been an even bigger score for Nepal had someone else managed to make a half century. And then Singapore were just terrible in reply. Nobody scored higher than 15, only four made double figures. And you look at some of those Nepal bowling figures, two bowlers taking four wickets with Basant Regmi only going for six runs. A pretty clinical display from Nepal.
And Uganda beat the United States fairly comfortably as well. Again, it was a rain-affected game, but Uganda only made 215. Makassar made 71 at the top. But the US reply never got going. They were 6 for 128 after 35.4 overs, which was some 24 runs behind the required target at that point when the rain came. And I guess the most unusual part of this is Jermaine Lawson wasn't playing this game, and they seem to have fitness issues through the squad.
Yeah, you look at the pace of the US innings as well. The top scorer was Srini Santhanam, who scored 37, but from 73 balls, and you just can't score that slowly in one day cricket these days. And you're the captain messiah out for a duck, you know. And he was just poor one day batting from the USA, and perhaps the fitness comes in there, like a fitness comes in there.
The fourth match day was a bit of an interesting one. We saw another sort of upset. We looked like Uganda was going to kind of coast through this tournament as they had the previous League Division 3, but they were lost to Malaysia by 4 wickets, bowled out for just 106, and Malaysia rescued what was starting to look like they might end up getting relegated, chased this down in 21 overs and managed to beat the rain, which was particularly important.
Yeah, very disappointing performance from Uganda in this game after such a good start to the tournament. If they'd have won this game, they'd have secured promotion with, you know, still a game to spare, and they're unable to do that. Mukasa failed, and Uganda have become increasingly reliable on him at the top of the order recently, and I know perhaps that threw Uganda off, and was, as you say, bowled out for 106, which Malaysia, you know, it wasn't easy. You know, they were 61 for 2 at one point, and, you know, we were eight, then all of a sudden they were 89 for 6, and, you know, they very nearly, you know, had a bit of a scare there, but you obviously recovered to get the 4-wicket win.
And the other two games were washed out, but not before a really substantial amount of play was played. Singapore made 266 against Bermuda before that game was washed out, and Bermuda didn't actually take the field. And the United States only made 204 against Nepal, but they had them 3 for 27, which, if that game had gone just a little bit longer, may have made things a little bit interesting for Nepal.
Yeah, I think after you're removing the top three of Nepal's order, you know, even though Paris Kadka was still at the crease, you would have probably expected USA to go on to win that game. So, you know, the rain certainly saved Nepal there. In the World Cricket League, they do have this thing where you restart a game from the beginning when it's washed out, rather than continue it from where they left off, which is what they do in the World Cricket League Championship. So, quite an inconsistent playing condition there. And, yeah, but Nepal, I think, got away with one there.
Is it the games were replayed the following day, and Bermuda were bowled out for 124 against Singapore, and that allowed Singapore, not without a bit of a scare, actually. They ended up 7 down chasing it, but they managed to do it in 31.3 overs, which was important because it looked like net run rate might come into figure on the final day.
Yeah, again, another pretty terrible batting performance from Bermuda. And, yeah, an easy win for Singapore in the end, despite the loss of wickets. Some very unusual things in this game happened. Alan Douglas started the Singapore innings as wicketkeeper for Bermuda, and then took off the pads and bowled an over, and he later got reported for a suspect action in the tournament. So a very strange captaincy from Bermuda there. Singapore sort of deserved winners of that, and Bermuda, I think, could confirm the relegation with the game still to spare.
And in the other match, Nepal ended up winning by only 10 runs on the Duckworth-Lewis method after, again, it rained. A little bit fortunate for the tournament organisers that they didn't end up playing 1.5 games and not actually get a result in this. US made 223, and at this time Nepal's top order didn't fail, which probably actually saved them because they were 1 for 73 after 22 overs, which was sufficient for them to win the game by 10 runs.
Yeah, and you saw in this game that the fitness issue, Jermaine Lawson, after only bowling 4 overs in the rained-off game the day before, was unable to play in this game. So obviously, that was evidence of the lack of fitness of Lawson and some of the other US players there. And, yeah, very easy win for Nepal, really.
Which meant on the final day that there was a couple of things with the points table going into it. The first was that Bermuda's net run rate was so bad that although in theory they could probably not be relegated, it was going to take an absolute miracle. The other point was that Malaysia, USA and Singapore were probably going to be fighting out for the final to avoid the final relegation spot, and that Nepal and Uganda were almost certain, but not entirely certain, to go forward, particularly if Malaysia had beaten Nepal by a significant margin, or if Uganda, whose net run rate was fairly weak, had lost their game and Malaysia had won, then they wouldn't have gone up. So there was quite a lot of interest going into the final day, as there often is in this tournament, and it turned out to be fairly interesting. I think it's fair to say that Nepal won their match over Malaysia fairly comfortably. They bowled Malaysia for 142 and were 89 for 2 off 25 overs when, again, there was some rain.
Yeah, pretty dominant performance from Nepal in that game. Anwar Aruddin scored 69 for Malaysia, but there wasn't much else to write home about for their innings. And Nepal, you know, scored the runs quickly, got ahead of the, well ahead of the Duckworth Lewis target when the rain came.
And Uganda did much the same against Bermuda. They bowled them out for 140 off 39.5 overs, and then chased this down with the 451 balls remaining and only 3 wickets down. So both Nepal and Uganda confirmed fairly comfortably that they were the two teams going up.
And again, another good innings from Mukasa for Uganda here. He scored 86 on just 68 balls.
Whereas the final game was fascinating, to say the least. Singapore had made 225 off their 50 overs, and the United States, when it began to rain, looked fairly comfortably in a position to chase. They were in front on Duckworth Lewis, and in fact Singapore was later banned, the Singapore captain, for slowing down the over rate so much that he would, in an attempt to actually avoid a result in this game, so that they wouldn't actually lose and therefore be relegated. But once the rain cleared, the match having been got past the 20 overs, the US collapsed in really remarkable fashion to end up losing by quite a bit, actually, 33 runs.
Yeah, you know, they went from 132 for 3 to 146 for 8, and then, you know, the tail sort of hung around for a bit, but you couldn't really get to the close to the target. And yeah, I think, you know, it sort of summed up the USA's tournament in many ways, just completely disappointing.
Yeah, Vijay Kumar took 4 for 43 to, I guess, save his side from being relegated. And as I say, an incredibly disappointing tournament from the USA. It seemed, again, and to have been wrecked by preparation issues, and the fact that they were pretty much the only team that didn't do any sort of preparation going into it, because it was cancelled, the trip to Jamaica that they were supposed to make. And it seemed that they hadn't done a proper selection process. They picked up Jermaine Lawson. It's not clear whether, perhaps just on the basis of the New York Times article, that he was possibly available for them, because, as you say, he missed a couple of games through apparent fitness, and the batting order seemed to move around as usual, chaotic US cricket, and Belinda Baker's come out in the last couple of days to basically say not good enough.
Nobody is really happy with what's going on in the USA at the moment. You know, now the players are coming out. You know, Orlando Baker has said he's not going to play for the USA until there's changes made. He's specifically talking about the coach, Robin Singh, who seems to just see coaching the USA as a hobby. He was lucky to really keep his job after, you know, what he said about the USA women's team a couple of years ago. He said that he had to lower his mental standards to communicate with them, which, you know, is a pretty insulting thing to say. The the quote here from Baker, he says, "The disrespect that Robin Singh brings to a changing room can kill a team no matter how good the team is and no matter how big a coach is. You don't talk to a grown man like the kids. That's what Robin carries. He bullies the players to play his band of cricket. You can't bully me. You can't bully a Tim Allen, a Barrington Bradley, because we're from the same culture and we don't take certain disrespect." Yeah, so it seems that Robin Singh's coaching methods have not got the best out of USA. You saw Clayton Lambert, who took them from Division 5 to Division 3 before he was sort of cast aside, and they brought in Robin Singh, and Robin Singh just hasn't really done anything for the team. In fact, he's probably made the team worse. You know, the administration of cricket in the USA is, you know, as people know, pretty terrible. You know, the players have tended to rise above that in the past, and now they're not doing, and it's worrying signs for the future.
Yeah, I think the biggest problem with Singh as the coach as well is that he's a part-time coach. He coaches around other places in the world, which would be great if he's engaged and he's able to, in the times that he's with the side, lift them, and if he was capable when he's not there of still keeping in touch with what's actually happening in US cricket and therefore be able to help them. But he does actually give the impression that he just kind of flies in for a tournament. He's the big name and he does what he needs to do, and that the rest of the time there's no sort of development going on with the side whatsoever, which when Clayton Lambert was the coach was apparently not the case, and certainly the results are reflecting that.
Yeah, you're absolutely right. You need a coach who, you know, even if he's not with the team full time, he's paying attention to what's going on and engages with the team regularly, and you just don't get the feeling that Robin Singh does that.
Bermuda has probably had even larger fallout with their relegation. Again, it was a fairly poor preparation. Obviously, there was an issue with the tournament being moved at short notice, and they had at least had a bit of preparation in Dubai before they went over. But through the papers in Bermuda and in the period since then, and comments from the coach Alan Douglas in an interview, it's clear that there's a number of things going on in Bermudan cricket that are a bit of a problem and is reflected in the side. But first is that there's no youth coming through, that they've basically, schools cricket has declined from a decade ago, which was where they got their players that took them to the World Cup from. And so this is why Lionel Cairn, since retired, he came out that after the tournament, said that relegation wasn't a surprise. It was a bit of pill to swallow, but it would have been an incredible feat for them to stay up. And because when they started training in August, only four guys turned out for the training session. And that's a terrible position for a side to be in, particularly in Bermuda, where they should be able to train together fairly regularly.
Yeah, you know, Bermuda isn't a big place. It's very small. And this lack of commitment is something that you see quite often in Bermuda cricket these days. There was a time a couple of years ago when the former England player Geoffrey Boycott was in Bermuda and saw Malachi Jones bowling in a club match and said to him, I'll come and I'll do some coaching with you and I'll look to try and get you to play some cricket in Yorkshire back in England and perhaps even play some county cricket. He thought he was that good, and Malachi Jones just didn't turn up for this. And this lack of commitment is a real area of concern for Bermuda. And you've been relegated now to Division 4, and if things don't turn around, I can see them going down to Division 5 again. You can well see them doing an Argentina, but perhaps even worse, they're going to end up dropping from Division 1 right down. And it's a real tragedy, really. But it's something that seems to be afflicting the Americas region. I've written an article for Cricket Europe about this, and when you look at the average performance of teams from the Americas region in World Cricket League, the average team has been relegated two divisions. You know, Canada have gone from Division 1 to Division 2, Argentina from 2 to 6 and out of the system, and the Cayman Islands from Division 3 to Division 5, I think. And everybody's been relegated. The USA have improved the starting position, but they've been distinctly unimpressive, as we said, and it's becoming tragic, really, what's going on in the Americas. And when it comes down to it, they just aren't playing any 50-over cricket outside of domestic cricket in the World Cricket League. Bermuda hadn't played a 50-over match in 18 months before this tournament. And when you're coming up against sides like Nepal, Malaysia and Singapore, who are playing 50-over cricket regularly and at senior level, at under-19 level, at under-16 level, you're going in with that lack of preparation, you're always going to fail.
Yeah, no, it's obviously exacerbated by the fact that their local full member just can't support them at all. Right? They can't support themselves in the West Indies partly for the distance to travel and also because they've got no money. But I guess also because West Indies cricket is itself poorly governed and a fragmented governance because of the number of nations involved, Bermuda can't call on them for the sort of help that we're seeing from, particularly in recent times, Sri Lanka, giving to their local associates, and Australia gives to their local associates, and England gives to their local associates, give or take. The Americas are just not getting the preparation that other nations in the region are doing. They're not seeing players go for scholarships and things like that. And Bermuda has a few players who are playing in England, and those players are relatively committed, but a lot of other players are being drawn towards football or just playing in their local domestic and not taking their cricket seriously, and that's a big problem for an international side, especially when you're trying to compete with sides who are taking it seriously.
Yeah, you have to wonder as well how much this comes down to the administration of the ICC Americas region. What are they doing to try and help bring these sides up? We've spoken on a previous episode about ICC Americas scrapping their women's tournament, and the ICC Americas have probably cut down their men's divisional structure more than any other region has. There's only, I think, 9 teams left playing regional cricket in Americas from a high of, I think, maybe 16. And you have to wonder what is going on in ICC Americas. And when you see your island playing in the West Indies domestic 50-over competition instead of Canada or the USA or Bermuda, what are the people at ICC Americas doing to help bring on these teams? And the answer would seem to be not much.
Looking at the other teams, Malaysia and Singapore will be, I guess, pleased that they managed to stay in WCL3, and I think it's probably roughly where their level is, and it did seem like Nepal and Uganda are the class teams in the tournament. So both of those teams, I guess, all four of those teams would probably be quite pleased that they met expectations. One might say that the Americas teams also met expectations, but in the wrong way.
Yeah, very much. Yeah, I think Malaysia and Singapore are probably at their level, that sort of Division 3 level. And Nepal and Uganda, I think the key for Nepal and Uganda in future will be to stay in Division 2. Uganda have been yo-yoing between Division 2 and Division 3 for some time now. Nepal came up from Division 3 into the World Cup qualifier last year, and then relegated back down to Division 3, so they need to maintain position as well. Moving back to Malaysia and Singapore, if they can continue to maintain this position, and then maybe kick on perhaps next time, if not get promoted, get close to getting promotion, then look at promotion in the future. I think it's a positive sign for Asian cricket, but perhaps not if what we're hearing about the ICC wanting to take over the running of the region comes to pass.
Yeah, it'll be incredibly difficult for both Nepal and Uganda in WCL 2. There's no weak teams in that group. To some extent, the teams that are weaker are Kenya and Canada, which, again, Canada being in the Americas region, and probably a very slight risk, but not necessarily a small one, of dropping another division themselves down to WCL 3, which would be a disaster for the Americas region if that happened.
Yeah, Canada have basically done nothing, I think, since the World Cup qualifier. I haven't seen any matches for them this year. The national domestic competition doesn't seem to have been played this year. If it was on a very small scale. And it's worrying signs for Canada as well as the whole Americas region.
Moving on to the other matches that were played in the last few weeks, Andrew, I guess the most interesting ones are the Papua New Guinea and Hong Kong matches that have been played in Townsville. The tour that I think is good to see for a number of reasons. First of all, for Cricket Australia and the ICC East Asia Pacific to make the venue available and to organise for the teams to go there to play, but also to stream the matches so that people in PNG and in Hong Kong have had the opportunity to watch and to see it. And the first official one-day international matches for PNG and the first for a while for Hong Kong. Both matches went Papua New Guinea's way. Both were really close and entertaining, though. The first one, Hong Kong batted first and made 202, and it didn't look like a big enough total. They lost a couple of wickets early and struggled to kind of make it there. The only decent score was Jamie Atkinson's 59. And PNG got there quite quickly, 39 overs, but they lost 6 wickets in it. Wasn't a completely dominant chase.
Yeah, certainly. 76 for 5 in the 17th order. It wasn't looking too good for Papua New Guinea. They were scoring runs reasonably quickly, but obviously you're losing 5 wickets that early on in the game. It's not often you can recover from that and chase down even a target as low as 203. But you have Vanu Maria and Charles Amini batted very well. They put on a just under 100 for the 6 wicket. Maria scoring 54, and then Amini went on to score 61 not out, and Papua New Guinea became the 6th team to win their first ever ODI.
Yeah, I think Hong Kong will be a bit disappointed that their fielding in this matchup is also a problem. The second one, that they had their opportunities to take catches that would have put them right on top and to break that partnership, and that was probably the difference in the end. The second match, Hong Kong again won the toss and batted. They made a much better fist of it. They made 261. It for a little while it looked like it was going to be even higher, but they had a little bit of a drop in through the mid-30s overs. No one went on past 55, but there was a number of contributions from players who made 40s and 50s. And Papua New Guinea did really well to chase down. We saw a really fantastic innings by Legas Siaka, who scored 109, and for Vani Maria, who scored 65, and that partnership was the difference.
Legas Siaka is definitely becoming a key member of the Papua New Guinea side. He scored 2 centuries at the World Cup qualifier in New Zealand at the beginning of the year, and now he's scored 109 in this ODI. I think he averages nearly 70 in List A cricket now, and he's definitely one to watch. And it's good to see him in both games. People would have perhaps, who weren't familiar with Papua New Guinean cricket, would have perhaps expected them to rely on Geraint Jones. Geraint Jones, he contributed. He made 20 odd in both games, but he certainly wasn't the best player. That's good to see they're not relying on Geraint Jones. He's just another member of the team. When you've got a player who's played at a high level as Jones has, he played Test cricket for England, and coming into one of these teams, it can sometimes cause the other players to rely on them, and it's good that they're not doing that. And I caught the last sort of hour of the match, and it was a very exciting run chase. It looked a little ropey for Papua New Guinea after Siaka was out, and they lost 3 wickets. But Maria managed to keep the innings together, and he batted very well, and hit the winning runs. Sort of 4 balls from the end. They get a bit lucky. He hit the ball almost straight to a Hong Kong fielder, but the fielder lost the ball in the sun, and it went for 4. So a good win for Papua New Guinea, and as I mentioned, they were the 16th to win the first ODI, but they're the first team to win the first 2 ODIs. So a little bit of history there for Papua New Guinea.
Also, a fantastic innings from Anshuman Rath for Hong Kong. He's only 17 and batting at 3, which is fairly impressive. Hong Kong was missing Nisket Khan and Mark Chapman as well, which is probably something that would certainly strengthen their batting. Rath himself was run out by Legas Siaka with just a fantastic piece of fielding, would have marked any match at any level with the run out direct hit. Rath was just perhaps dawdling very slightly, but it was probably the difference between the two sides was the fielding. I think Hong Kong dropped 4 or 5 catches across the 2 games, and PNG is, for anyone who's seen them, is fantastically athletic throughout, and that, I guess, was the difference.
Certainly, I only saw Hong Kong field, and I was distinctly unimpressed on both occasions. And so, I think the fielding can often be a difference in teams between teams at this level. That the best fielding teams tend to do the best, and you know, fielding is something that associates certainly need to work on. It used to be what helps them compete with full members. They couldn't compete with the batting and bowling, but they could compete with the fielding. But as full members have moved on with their fielding coaching methods, it seems that the associates haven't. But so fielding is certainly an extremely important part of the game. It sounds silly to say that, but you know, especially at this level, I think.
There will be a 3-day match that will start shortly after we've recorded this, and so it'll be interesting to see the results of that. We'll talk about it in the next podcast, of course. But I'm not sure either side's played much 3-day cricket, but they're going to get quite a bit of it soon, and if they're playing when they start the Intercontinental Cup, so certainly they'll be interested to transition, because I think neither side is actually well known for batting sensibly throughout one-day international matches.
Yeah, so Papua New Guinea have been playing some two-day cricket in South Australia recently, but they've certainly never played anything at an international level, and certainly never played over 3 days. Hong Kong have played in the Intercontinental Cup back in 2005, and in the old ACC Fast Track Nations tournament, they played some 3-day cricket. They recently played a trial game in Hong Kong, sort of two teams selected by the Hong Kong selectors, and played a 3-day game against each other. And you know, Irfan Ahmed scored over 200 in that game, and he, you know, he certainly looked like he could adapt to multi-day cricket. But you know, we'll see how he does against you know, another country in conditions he's not as familiar with. But in general, it's good to see that the teams are arranging multi-day matches outside of the Intercontinental Cup. You see Nepal and Hong Kong are playing some 3-day matches on their tour of Sri Lanka, and also this game. And whenever associates are playing these multi-day matches outside of the ICC-organised tournaments, it's always great to see.
There are a couple of other smaller tournaments that were played. The Asian Cricket Council's Under-16 Elite Tournament, which is the second level, despite the name Elite, was played and were won fairly comprehensively by Afghanistan. They defeated Hong Kong in the final match to win the tournament. The other three teams that were involved did kind of struggle. It's probably not a surprise, because you would expect Afghanistan and Hong Kong to have quite strong junior programs. It's probably a bit of a surprise that they're at that level, particularly Afghanistan. But Kuwait did okay, and Iran and Qatar obviously have quite a lot of work to do to improve their junior cricket.
Yeah, so you're certainly right there. Afghanistan and Hong Kong by far the best two sides. Very interesting in this tournament that they played two games a day at the same ground, and one of them was a day-night game. I can't think many. Your under-16 tournaments have had day-night games played as part of them. So you know, that was a very unique experience for some of the players. And Afghanistan, they struggled in the last time they were at the top division in Asian under-16 cricket, and hopefully that they can stay in the top division when it comes around, I think, next year.
Afghanistan's under-19s had 3 matches against Pakistan's under-19s, which was a good thing to see, and particularly impressive was that they actually won the series 2-1. Not familiar enough with either of those two sides to know if they were both at full strength, but the Afghanistan won the first match by 10 wickets and the third by 69 runs, and lost the second by 7 wickets. So it was a fairly impressive effort by them, and will hold them in good stead when the World Cup Under-19 World Cup rolls around.
Yeah, it certainly will. The Pakistan and Afghanistan under-19s have played a few times this year, and earlier this year Afghanistan beat them by 200 and odd runs, and now recording a 10-wicket win in the first game of this 3-match series, and going on to win the series. And as far as I can tell, it's the first time that an associate has beaten a full member in a series at whatever level. So, a great performance by Afghanistan. I have to say, I'm not too sure how strong the Pakistan under-19 squad was. A very superb display from Afghanistan.
We also saw some matches between United Arab Emirates and Pakistan A. The UAE played in five, I guess, unofficial one-day international matches in there, and won two. They lost three. They weren't completely full strength because they were testing players out, and obviously there's work commitments and so forth. But again, that's quite a good performance. They're playing at home in Dubai, but to win a couple of games against the Pakistan A side after the struggles that they had at times in the Australian tours is a good sign.
Yeah, it certainly is. I think they'll be playing against New Zealand A, I think later this month or earlier next month maybe. So the World Cup preparation of the UAE looks to be going reasonably well, and we'll see what happens. But yeah, good to see them beat Pakistan A in two games.
Moving on to news, Andrew, we will stick with the Asian region, and the Cricket Association of Nepal has been dissolved and replaced by a three-member ad hoc committee. This is part of their ongoing governance reform. The government has basically taken over because of the alleged corruption and appointed other people to the board. It's expected that they'll reform under a new name and with their new executive that they've already hired and continue on, and hopefully this will improve Nepalese governance in the future.
Yeah, I think we all remember 2 years ago when the ICC decided to ban government interference in cricket, and look how long that lasted. Administration in Nepal is probably the biggest barrier to them moving on, as we see in the USA as well. And to some extent, it doesn't matter how good the team is if the administrators can't get themselves together and develop the team adequately. And as much as I dislike government interference in cricket administration, if they can get a better organisation in place that will help stop Nepal facing ICC suspension, which let's not forget, next year they do face ICC suspension because they've been put on notice this year if they don't get their act together, and hopefully something good can come out of this.
There's a couple of bits of news in Africa. It was very upsetting, I guess, to learn that the captain of the Kenyan women's team, Emily Ruto, has died of leukemia in the past couple of weeks, and had been hoping to get some treatment, and obviously that had not come about before the illness took over. And she'd been a bit of a pioneer for women's cricket in Kenya, and to get in on track, so very disappointing.
Yeah, to die of leukemia at just 25 years old is, it's an absolute tragedy, I think. Ruto had played in, I think, every Kenyan women's international, and she'd been such a key member of the side, and it really is a tragedy. You can't really say any more than that.
We have slightly better news out of Nigeria, though, that the government there has given money to the Nigerian Cricket Federation through their sports council to build some turf pitches and some training facilities. And Nigerian cricket is one that's moved up a couple of divisions in the World Cricket League, and obviously being a very big country, they have a lot of potential. So to see the Sports Commission to get on board and to their schools federation as well, and bringing cricket into the schools games, means that hopefully we'll continue to see the Nigerian cricket improve.
Yeah, I mean, obviously Nigeria didn't play too well in Africa Division 2 recently, and any investment into developing facilities and developing cricket in schools is always a great thing to see, and hopefully this can help Nigeria progress even more than they have done recently.
And there's a couple of interesting bits of news coming out of Europe. We'll start with Guernsey. They've been looking at the idea of playing in the Sussex League from 2016 in order to get their team a higher standard of cricket that they can work on, and to have their players playing at that standard more regularly. They obviously have links to Sussex County already, and with a couple of players involved in the county system. So it's not a cheap thing, but it seems to be something that they're quite keen to pursue.
Yeah, I think the report I've read says it could cost them as much as £50,000 a year, which is, it's not a insignificant sum, it's quite a big chunk of their ICC funding. Hopefully they can get some sponsorship to help them do this. There are teams from Guernsey who play in the lower levels of English football and rugby union, and those teams have to pay their, as well as paying to travel to England to play away games, they have to pay their opponents' airfares and whatnot when they come to play in Guernsey. So it's an expensive prospect. They're only talking about playing half a season, so just sort of 10 or 11 games rather than actually play a full season, because obviously they'll have, ICC tournaments to play in as well, hopefully. It'd be interesting to see where this goes, and I'm not sure of the standard of play in the Sussex League, and hopefully it'll help challenge Guernsey to become a better side.
And I recently joked on Twitter that I'd talk about France cricket more regularly on the podcast if they started governing themselves a bit more like USA cricket, and they've taken me my word by the sounds of things. There was an article written by Roy Gribble, who, we full disclaimer, has been on the show, and talking about the governance of French cricket and his particular issues with selection implied by that occurred as a result of him making comments that they were being unrealistic about their expectations. It appears in response that the president of French cricket has filed a defamation suit, and we'll see what happens from there.
Yeah, we have to be very careful about how we speak about this if there's a potential legal case going ahead. But one thing I will say is that I am not entirely sure that suing a former player is the best use of France's ICC funding.
Looking forward to the next few weeks. A couple of tournaments on. The most significant is probably the East Asia Pacific 2020 tournament, which will be followed with a few 50-over games as well. They'll have eight nations involved. Eight of the nine nations that are within the East Asia Pacific, the only one that's not involved is South Korea, which is very disappointing given the effort that's been put into developing this side. Obviously, because Papua New Guinea didn't qualify automatically last year, the only one team from East Asia Pacific will be going through to the smaller tournament, which is only 14 teams. So we'll expect Papua New Guinea to get out of this, given their relatively ranking compared to the other nations.
Vanuatu are sort of starting to catch up Papua New Guinea, but they're still quite a way behind them. And Fiji have been putting in some good preparation. They've been playing in Australia for a couple of weeks recently against a few local sides. But even there, I can't see them challenging Papua New Guinea, who I think will probably just cruise to qualify for the World 2020 qualifier.
And I think the 50-over matches will also decide who goes into the World Cricket League in the newly formed World Cricket League Division 6. Vanuatu's already in that division, so there's quite a bit to play for Fiji to move that up, and possibly either Samoa or Japan, who also hope to qualify.
Yeah. So the top four teams from the 2020 tournament that aren't Papua New Guinea and Vanuatu will play a very quick knockout tournament to decide the East Asia Pacific qualifier for the next World Cricket League Division 6 tournament. Vanuatu are already in Division 6. And, they're not as important as the World 2020, as the 2020 tournament, but still very important to get into that World Cricket League and perhaps try and progress up the divisions there. It's good to see East Asia Pacific using a 50-over tournament to decide their World Cricket League participants. Africa have used a 2020 tournament Asia will, of course, use a one-day tournament. Europe are using a one-off one-day match between France and Norway to decide their participant. Where Americas will just use 2020. They don't play any 50-over cricket anymore, as we discussed earlier. So, yeah, very crucial match. I think you'd probably expect Fiji to come through that 50-over tournament to get that World Cricket League place.
And the other significant tournament, which has started as we recording today, the ACC's Under-19 Premier Tournament has been played in Kuwait. It was delayed by one day because of visa issues, which seems to be an ongoing issue for tournaments played in Kuwait. There are six teams involved, Afghanistan, Nepal, UAE, Malaysia, Saudi Arabia and Kuwait. The winner of this event will go forward to the Under-19 World Cup and the second place to a repechage tournament with the other regions, which I think is something we've mentioned as a good idea a couple of times on this podcast, Andrew.
Yeah, it's certainly a very sensible thing to do. Rather than have two teams go to a 10-team tournament that then produces six qualifiers, which is a bit overkill, to have the winners go direct to the World Cup and then the runners-up play this repechage tournament, I think is a great move from the ICC. It's not often we find ourselves complimenting the ICC, but that is a relatively sensible solution. And I think you'd probably back Afghanistan to get that direct place into the World Cup, especially after the opening day performance. They bowled Malaysia out for 101 and then chased down that target in less than 10 overs. About as comprehensive as a win as you can get. And I think the runner-up, I think you'd probably expect to maybe be Nepal, but it'd be an interesting tournament to see who gets that runners-up spot.
I think we've complimented the ICC a number of times, at least parts of it, in this episode, Andrew. We're obviously getting soft in our old age.
We must be. We'll need to, I'm sure they'll do something to annoy us before the end of the year.
That's all I have. Thanks very much.
Thank you, as usual.